Hello and welcome back to the Dune Minute Podcast, your place to dive deep, minute by minute, into the cinematic adaptation of Frank Herbert's World of Dune. I'm one of your hosts, Zach.
And I'm John. And today is a special day.
Woo!
Because not only are we talking about this week my possibly five favorite minutes of this movie, but also we have our first guest. Joining us is my friend Charlie, who has been my friend for a very long time and is also a big old fucking Dune nerd. So hello, how are you?
Hello. I love worms.
You love worms?
Yeah.
I love lamp.
Also, fuck you. She's my friend too.
No, she's my friend first. Yes. No, we've known Charlie for a very long time and, we're excited to have you here. Excited to talk about some worm and, some Dune. So last week we ended off with the chaos that was ensuing as Shai Hulud was beginning to approach the crawler. So we're going to pick right back up where we left off. At this point, we're starting minute 65 with contact in 2 minutes.
That's right.
So over the last, I didn't actually look, I should have, to see if they're portraying everything in real time. Because
that's a good thought.
We had that like contact in 5 minutes and then Now we're at contact in 2 minutes. If only I had some notes that I could go back and look at to see. It is not real time.
That's the kind of meticulous detail that I expect from you.
No.
While John's looking that up, Charlie, how did you get introduced to this crazy cinematic world or the books or the movies or whatever?
The books initially, my ex-husband started reading Dune and he was explaining it to me. And my first thought was, this sounds exactly like Star Wars, but better. What is, what is happening?
You were correct.
Little did I know. And then there was all sorts of news items about impending movie. And once I saw that Denis Villeneuve was attached to it, I went elbow deep because I love that man.
Just
I think
full on hyper fixation.
Oh yeah. Everything. I just absorbed everything that I possibly could. Especially after seeing his work with Blade Runner and just kind of seeing
that was good.
What he does with existing IP, I guess, how he kind of makes it his own, but also respects the original source material. And I don't know, dude's got like a really good eye for sci-fi. And also knowing that he grew up being obsessed with the books, that was pretty awesome. But what sent me over the edge was learning that Hans Zimmer had abandoned Christopher Nolan and said, fuck you. I'm going to go make Dune. You are on your own for these next two movies. And yeah, that is when the hyperfixation began.
What movies did he abandon Nolan over?
Tenet and Oppenheimer.
Okay. Yeah.
Which I contend those are his two worst movies because in retrospect, if you look back on it, the most memorable thing about Christopher Nolan movies are the scores.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the scores are all Hans Zimmer. The ones that you remember anyway.
I don't think a good score could have saved Tenet.
Tenet had a lot of issues.
I don't know if that movie is.
No, Tenet to me always looked like it was made by a film student with way too much mommy daddy money. Let me throw as much money as I can at this. But it doesn't matter if the concept is all thought out.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I saw it once and I was like, oh, I'd never have to see that again. No. That's lovely.
I feel like Nolan had to be like, how do I out-weird Inception? And he was just like, time travel, not dream travel. And then now we're just like, all right. But we're not here to talk about Tenet or Nolan. We're here to talk about Dune. Went back in my notes. The timing is actually correct. It was minute 62 to 63. We had the call out for contact in 5 minutes. We are now in 65 through 66. Contact in 2.
All right. So, look at them. Continuity. You love to see it.
Someone was paying attention in the editing room.
Yeah.
We see Spotter 1 hovering over the extract zone. Or, sorry, a spotter. Spotter 1 was the one that was flying over Shai Hulud. But there's a spotter hovering over that extract zone. And we had the question last week of, you know, how are these just kind of being propelled and whatnot? You can kind of see a, you know, jet stream directly underneath the spotter as it's kind of levitating there in the air. So that's how, I guess, we were wrong about the magnets, but oh well.
We don't even know how those work.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think anyone knows.
The words we hear from the spotter are getting close, guys. We better abandon ship, which I thought was a very like oddly like present statement. Like that's something that you would hear walking down the street today. And it's,
you just hear random people on the street saying we better abandon ship.
Well, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Atlanta's a fun place, man. We get all, we have all sorts here.
That's true.
No, it's just like, it's very casual language, I guess that's what I meant to say.
Yeah.
It does. It's kind of a, in a weird contrast to the kind of the,
all of the stuffy urgency we had.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that spotter pilot just thinks that he's like calm and cool, like Han Solo and shit.
Sure. Sure.
He's got main character syndrome.
Yeah.
Right. Well, if he was that cool, he'd be in a carry-on, not a spotter. I'm just saying.
I mean, that is true. He's a little, a little big for his britches. Leto then begins questioning where, you know, the men are, and Liet Kynes kind of navigates about the cockpit to try and get a better view, presumably to help look for the workers that are leaving this carryall. And then we hear over the radio the guys from the carryall just be like, yeah, no, we're not getting out because we're going to die. What he actually says is there's protocol for a reason. If we take one step out there, we're as good as dead. Besides, we've got a full load of spice. We can't just leave it. And then we see, or Leto then gets super pissed off and angry. And he's like, damn the spice. I want every man off that crawler. Now, at this moment, we see Dr. Kynes kind of do a little side glance over at Leto, though.
Oh, yeah. She looks him up and down.
Yeah. So seemingly impressed by the fact that he doesn't give a shit about, you know, the actual spice and cares more about his men. And like we talked about 2 weeks ago, how she's got a interesting history and background, given that she's half Fremen.
Yeah. I'll sprinkle in more from the books that, that I read as we go on. But yeah, that's, you're right.
Seems to be impressive to her, not only that he cares about his men, but that he'd be willing to leave behind this, like, obviously the most valuable substance in the known universe for his men.
Do we talk about how calculating a move that was?
Go for it.
Yeah.
I mean, in the book, when we hear him, not hear him, but when we see his conversations with Paul, everything is measured. Everything is calculated. He understands strategy to a T. Mm-hmm. And the scene in the book, to me, the way that it read was, if I can impress upon this person that I'm not like my predecessor, I care more about people than the spice, then maybe this person will get the impression that I'm not here to, what is the word? Oh, shit.
Colonize,
exploit. I'm not here to just exploit the planet. And maybe I can present myself as a partner rather than an overlord.
Sure. that's all fine and good for Leto, but Chome doesn't give a shit.
Oh,
the Spacing Guild doesn't give a shit. And if they don't get their spice, there's going to be a problem because,
of course,
as with everything, money and politics like to, you know, mix
but
a little
as,
bit.
But as he is the face of this, these two organizations right now, I think he understands that he's got to put a good face on it, be a better partner.
Sure.
And I think my point is that it's not altruism like we see in the movie where he's just like, oh, my men, I got to protect all these people. No, it's a much more like more precise a move on his part.
And that's something
he's positioning. He's
absolutely.
Yeah. And that's something we talk about in several episodes too, is just that, you know, there's a lot of hidden details from the books that don't make it to the movie for, you know, time reasons or for, you know, avoiding instances like we have with the Lynch film where half the movie is just internal monologue.
Yeah.
you know, so I think they do a good enough job of just kind of like trying to present Leto as the good guy and everything.
I mean,
as good of a guy as he can be.
Sure. And by comparison, he is. He's a great guy.
Yeah.
Compared to who ruled previously.
You don't think Rabin's a great guy?
I think he's delightful.
He's a beast, man. That's a good thing, right?
Yeah.
That's
a good
nickname.
Yeah, yeah. Something like that.
It's hard for me to see Dave Bautista in this role.
I think he plays it so well.
He does a really good job.
He does, but in his other roles, when he's just like earnest and sweet and kind, it's like, that's what sticks with me. It's so hard to see him this way. No, he kills it.
Yeah.
Whatever he does, he absolutely kills.
It's such a small role, but you know, we were talking about Blade Runner earlier.
Oh my God.
His role in Blade Runner is,
that's the part that always sticks with me.
Yeah.
He was the epitome
so
of
good.
More human than human.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. No, that was clearly Denis loved working with him on that.
Yeah.
So he decided to give him Beast Rabin, for Dune. But yeah, no, he killed that. And I think he does a very good job of the stupid, angry, strong guy in Dune.
Absolutely. I'm more impressed by than anything else by his ability to tone down the charisma. Cause he's got that crazy wrestler charisma.
Yeah.
And
anyone in that wrestling world has to.
Jesus Christ. They're magnetic. But just to be able to like turn that off or like dial it down, I think that's what makes him super impressive.
Yeah.
You know, it's being dialed up. The fucking sandworm activity outside.
Hell
this,
yeah, it
this
is.
Crawler. We get a. Yeah, this was like where I was like, CGI, this is where they put their money into like to this stuff right here. These kinds of scenes. We talked a couple weeks ago about how there's some parts where they kind of skimped a little bit, like with some not great looking sand dunes during some of the ornithopter flyovers.
CGI budget was stretched a little thin on some spots.
Things that you won't notice in a normal watching, but when we're insane people and watch it second by second, you kind of see it.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
But when we start seeing like the dune behind them start to like bellow and just explode outwards. Great stuff.
Which is one of my favorite shots of the entire film.
Yeah.
In combination with all of the music that's going on, because like throughout this whole thing, we have, you know, just like tense underlying music. And then when we see the dune explode from Shai Hulud, just kind of passing underneath it, it just gets even louder and crazier and more explosive and everything. I also just love that there's a bunch of like half bends and like microtonal stuff going on with the music too, to add to that level of tension that's going on with everything.
I didn't notice that, but it seemed to have worked because it is very tense.
Yeah. I mean, you only have this massive, you know, several hundred meter long, sandworm rushing at you at, what did we calculate, 27 and a half miles an hour? something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
44 kilometers an hour, something like that.
740 meters per minute or 27.5 miles an hour. Yeah. Okay. Which doesn't sound fast.
No.
But when you realize that the fastest humans can only run, you know, way less than that.
Specificity is the soul of narrative, John.
Yeah. I don't. Beautifully sorry, put. Sorry, I can't just like pick out fucking.
I believe it's around the 30 mile an hour mark.
That's fastest human?
Cheetahs. Sorry. Cheetahs can run.
Yeah, no,
sorry.
I'm talking about
there was part of that sentence that stayed in my head. My bad. Yeah, I believe cheetahs run around like 30 something miles an hour, and that's the fastest. Like
cheetahs run faster than that.
All right, man. We getting into a cheetah measuring contest? We
are. I feel like I remember 60 because they can't keep it up for very long.
Yeah, no, they have like, 50 to 80 miles an hour.
Jesus Christ, 80 miles all an right. hour?
Then humans might be 30.
That feels like a stretch.
I don't know.
Do we?
Are we?
Usain Bolt, hold on.
Just going to mark that for edit.
Human speed, human male running speed is 8 miles an hour.
But the fastest.
Usain Bolt is 10.44 meters per second. What is that in American measurement? 27.
Okay.
That is like.
That's like sprint speed, though, not sustained.
Yeah.
Either way, Shai Hulud is doing 27.5 sustained.
All right.
You're not going to outrun it.
No, absolutely not.
That's the point.
Yep. So we cut to Paul down on the ground at this point. He's directing folks away from the crawler. You know, seven over here, seven over there.
He's screaming at them. And I don't know if you've tried yelling around like helicopters before. You can't hear shit.
No.
Like,
yeah. You can't hear yourself thinking.
No. It's like, Gold Star, you tried. At least he's like kind of pointing so they can maybe get an idea. But yeah. Then we just see this dust cloud appear.
And they told them that. They told him the plan over the radio.
They did.
So he's. But
Gold Star, you tried.
Yeah. And then, yeah, this is it. This is the pivotal moment right here.
Leto wanted to be a pilot and Paul wanted to be an air traffic control man.
That's right. The ground crew.
Yeah. He's just sitting out there.
They should have given him the orange sticks. He's sitting out
there with the orange sticks, just kind of waving them around and shit.
But this is the moment. This is we get Paul getting hit with a big old dust cloud.
Yep.
And his psychedelic trip begins.
All of the music just gets shut out immediately with this big whoosh kind of sound. Mm-hmm.
This scene, I feel like, was coded as white man takes ayahuasca for the first time.
I mean, you're not
it's
wrong.
It's not wrong. It's not wrong.
He's tripping in the desert.
He's tripping in the desert.
Yeah.
I'm a changed man.
Paul goes to Burning Man.
Paul goes to Burning Man. I mean, if I was tripping balls, I'd probably be seeing giant worms too.
Right. So Paul tries to get his mask up to no avail. He's done for. He's cooked.
Yeah.
He got a big old lung full of spice. And he just starts like just tripping. That's the only way that I can describe it.
We start hearing the low rumbling of like multiple voices all at once.
Yeah.
And they start, and you know, kind of growling a little bit.
We know it was spice because we see the tiny orange red specks in the air. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Visual cues.
Also, we know because they were on a spice field.
Well, just in case you didn't know what's going on.
That is true. I do love, we talked about this, I think episode one.
Where you called me out for not knowing the difference between orange and red.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, like, I just love the motif that they have of, like, showing the influence of spice, because they always have the little speckles in the air.
The little glimmering glitter in the sand.
It's just, it's a cool little effect that they have, you know, throughout the movie. And you see it in other scenes where, like, it's where spice isn't necessarily, like, influencing people or their decisions, but you still see, like, little speckles here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not directly influencing anyone, but when it's in the air all the time.
Yeah, and when you get sucked into a giant cloud of it all at once. Your first time out in the desert.
I had a question for the group. Do you think this is Paul's first exposure to spice? I think there are two ways you could answer this, from a book reader's perspective and a movie watcher's perspective.
From a movie watcher's perspective, yes. Because he had his podcast on Arrakis, or on Caladan, explaining to him what spice was. Now, granted, that's probably not explaining to him. It's explaining to the audience.
Right.
But I think this is his... He had seen it before, because he had seen it when the Spacing Guild members were at the Ceremony of the Change. You know, he had seen the orange spice in their suits, their helmets and stuff. But I think this is his first, like, direct exposure to spice.
Okay. What do you think?
I don't know. Part of me always wondered, like, was his mom sneaking him a little bit here and there? Because she produced him out of turn.
Yep. Firmly believing that he would be the Kwisatz Haderach.
Right. So I think with all of that motivation, what would have prevented her from, like, pushing him along a little bit?
Yeah. Sprinkling some over his, like, Eggos or something in the mornings.
His cinnamon toast is extra cinnamony.
Yeah, exactly. I think from the movie's perspective, this is the first time that he's ever introduced to it. From a book reader perspective, I think that he would have had to have had some in the past.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Most of the, you know, it's a hard thing to come by. It's a very expensive, like, spice. In that universe, but the rich people, the noble houses, they can afford it.
Sure, got shit on Melange.
Yeah, right. they can afford it, and everyone knows about the geriatric properties. It makes you live longer and everything. Right. So, they're not the only, you know, the Spacing Guild's not the only organization that uses it. Mentats would, they do.
Okay, I thought we had
the Sappho juice just, like, heightens their stuff, but it's part of their training to do it. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, at least Peter DeVries does, because he's described in the books as having the blue eyes.
Okay.
Oh, he's like a spice fiend though. Yeah. Isn't
he's a hardcore druggie.
Yeah. Fucking Thufir Hawat's just doing lines off of hookers' asses.
Maybe, man. He lived a life.
So then, since they're secretly training him as a mentat, wouldn't we think that it's being snuck in somehow?
Yeah. Yeah. That storyline was dropped completely from the movie, which stinks, but, so from a book's perspective, I think that it's highly likely that he's had a little bit, in his life, but this scene doesn't exist in the books.
Yeah.
Or at least Paul being outside the ship during the scene, getting hit in the face with the dust doesn't exist. But he does get a big dose of spice later in the book. And he goes through his whole, like, fucking trip then.
Yes. Yeah.
I feel like the way that they handled it in the movie is a really, really good way of just kind of handling that, like, trip out in the desert versus later on.
Yeah.
So,
that's pretty much all
the minute
notes that I have. Charlie, at the end of each episode, I like to just give some book comparisons and say, like, what's going on at this point in the book. And you know, is there like through lines that we can trace and see what's going on? I kind of gave it away a second ago. I don't have any real analogies for this scene. Most of, you know, during this scene, Paul he's in the ship the whole time. Mm-hmm. He doesn't leave. So we don't get him being introduced to the spice, but I did want to make that note that he does get this like blast of super concentrated spice trip later in the book once they get outside into the desert with the Fremen. So mm-hmm. it's
once
there.
They fled.
Yeah, yeah. Once they flee the capital for sure.
Wow, dude, spoilers.
No, sorry. So it's there, but not exactly right in this moment.
Yeah.
I'm glad they kept it in there, because he has to have that like initial shock that to his system, like here's a whole fuckload of spice right all at once. And then that's what makes him like, he's like, oh shit, I can start to see everything.
I'm God.
Well, this is, it's the kind of scene that movies call for, because if we're speculating about him getting little micro doses of spice throughout his life, like that's not really easy to show.
Yeah.
In a movie where we want to spend not that much time on mm-hmm. prologue and his home life back on Caladan.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we only spent 35 minutes on Caladan, something like that. So there's not a lot of time.
Yeah.
but we've talked about a lot. There's a lot of content for them to have to get through for a 2.5 hour part one movie. So cuts have to be made, you know, here and there. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've said it many times, but they don't have the luxury of 600 pages of a novel. So,
but yeah, that is our minute ending with Paul just getting sucked into that cloud and kind of, beginning to lose his mind. So on tomorrow's episode, we'll talk a little bit more about Paul's spice trip. And if you want to, you can reach out to us on Instagram. We are at the Dune Minute. We're also on Twitter at Dune Minute, and you can email duneminute@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you if you have any questions or feedback or anything. And we will be back tomorrow with another episode of the Dune Minute podcast.
See you then.
See ya.